From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we speak with the French ambassador to the United States about his country's ties to Wisconsin and about the shared international goal of peace in the Middle East. Then we'll look back at the legacy of the Bayview Massacre, which took place 128 years ago this week.
Well, the governor had given them orders to stop the marchers under any cost. So at that point, the colonel said to his men, "Pick out your man, take aim, and kill him," and ordered the volley of shots into the crowd.
And two visiting guitarists performed together for the first time in Lake Effect Studio.
They've done it. Let's wrap up, and then we'll see how it goes.
Right, all right.
If they hear a fifth song, we'll know it worked.
Exactly. There you go.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. The French ambassador to the United States was in Milwaukee this week. François Delattre was on hand as a French water consortium signed a memorandum of understanding with the Milwaukee-based Water Council. Delattre met with local and state leaders and talked about the increasing economic ties between France and Wisconsin. The ambassador also joined Mitch Tyke at the Lake Effect studio to discuss the larger connections between France and the United States, including our shared interest in finding resolutions for foreign policy crises such as those in Ukraine and Syria. Delattre talked about why he believes France is in a good position to lead the effort to find peace in Syria.
We think Syria is one of the worst tragedies on this earth. And frankly, we are together with our American friends to try to find a way out of the crisis. For that, we consider, and we are working hard together, the French, the Americans, the British, the Germans, a few others, of course, in the region, to better support the moderate part of the opposition. That's the key challenge. If we want a political solution, we all know that the only possible solution will be political, then we need to have a different balance of power on the ground. And to do that, we need to better support the moderate part of the opposition against both Bashar and its regime, but also against the jihadist part of the opposition. And we are working along these lines. That's number one priority. The second priority, of course, is on the humanitarian front to increase our support to those literally millions of Syrians who are suffering, not only in Syria itself, by the way, but also in the neighboring countries where you have, for example, one-fourth of the population in Lebanon, country that is dear to our heart, that is made of Syrian refugees. So we need to help these refugees wherever they are. So two fronts, the political one, the humanitarian one, and also helping through various means the moderate part of the opposition.
France does seem to have the ear of the Syrians and the Middle East at large in a way that other Western powers, especially the United States, do not in this case.
Well, you know, through our history and relations, cultural means also, we are part of the equation, I believe, in this region. And that's why we are trying to help the best we can. And frankly, on this Syrian crisis, but also in many other, I would say on every other crisis in the world, we are working closely together between our two countries, the French and the Americans, like never before, I would say.
Well, and along those lines, if we could shift briefly to Ukraine, the United States sees its concern driven largely by the prospect of expanding Russian influence. What is France's take on the developments there, given the significance of your economic ties to Russia and to Ukraine?
Here again, the Ukrainian crisis, I believe, is a very good example of the fact that the transatlantic link is more vital than ever today. In Ukraine, we share, I believe, the two key objectives. Number one, to make sure through an attitude of firmness that Russia doesn't challenge borders in Ukraine, but also in other parts of Europe and potentially the world. If we open the Pandora's box of challenging borders, we frankly don't know where it's going to end. and that could be the addition of many tragedies on this earth. Second priority in Ukraine is to support the country. That's what we do, we the Europeans, not only the French, but the Germans, the British and the others, the Poles and the other, trying to support Ukraine through economic package that is $15 billion strong. So it's huge effort that we do with our European colleagues to support the Ukrainian economy in particular. And walking on these two legs, so to speak, firmness vis-à-vis Russia, but also greater support to Ukraine, we hope to find, painfully for sure, but to find a way out of this very difficult crisis.
Do you believe the economic sanctions are the right approach at this stage?
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. That's why we in Europe took a new set of sanctions together with our American friends. And I think we have, through sanctions, to have President Putin understand that there is a cost of Russia's attitude toward Ukraine and a growing cost. And that's why the sanctions policy belongs to the attitude of firmness I was referring to. And we are ready to go as far as we should, depending on the Russian attitude toward the country.
At the same time, Russia is an important economic trading partner with France as well.
I would say with Europe as a whole. And here you have two things to consider. We, France, are much less dependent from Russian oil and gas than many other European countries. In Europe, you have, I believe, six countries who are 100% dependent on Russian oil and gas. You have 12 who are more than 50% dependent. And frankly, in France, we are a bit, but not a lot, based on the nuclear energy that we have, providing 75% of our electricity consumption. So that's the first point. We are much less dependent from Russia in terms of energy import than other countries. And the second thing is that, yes, for sure, we have an economic partnership with Russia that is stronger, for example, in relative terms than the American one, but weaker than the German one. You know what I mean? In Europe, I think it's fair to say that Germany is the leading economic partner of Russia.
As we look at the relationship between France and the United States in times of crisis, I'm curious, you know, we are approaching the 70th anniversary of D-Day, which was probably the time of the greatest unity of all of the Allied countries. How much of that history do you see reflected in policy today in terms of the cooperation between the United States and France?
I believe frankly, it's a very good question. When President François Hollande, the French president, came to the United States 2 months ago for a state visit, the first in nearly 20 years, one of his key messages that he passed together with President Obama was the values that we share, that are the core of our joint DNA, do matter in the 21st century. That's why, for example, President Hollande went to Arlington Cemetery to bestow the Legion of Honor upon six American veterans of World War II, expressing to them the eternal gratitude of my country. That's also why President Obama and Hollande together went to Monticello, the home of Thomas Jefferson, who very well embodies these shared values of freedom and democracy that, after all, our two countries gave the world over 200 years ago. So to answer your question, yes, these values do matter in the 21st century. That's why it's so important that President Obama will go to Normandy on June 6th for the 70th anniversary of the Normandy D-Day landings. And if you put things into perspective in the various crises we briefly mentioned, Ukraine, Syria, you know, in the tragedies, in these testing times, these values that we share are more than ever our best guide, and as I used to say, our best moral compass to confront together the current challenges we face.
Of course, since President Hollande's visit to the United States, there has been a substantial shift in the government in France. I'm curious, how is the work of an ambassador affected by a change in governance, especially a relatively sudden shift such as what France experienced in April?
The thing is that In France, and I believe in most European countries, an ambassador is not a political appointee as you understand it in this country. In other words, I'm appointed by my president, and in my case, I was appointed by former President Sarkozy, then confirmed by President Hollande, so I'm completely apolitical. So appointed by the president, but not submitted to any political agenda. I think, again, it's the case of most of my European colleagues, we represent a country and not a government per se. So in terms of the recent changes you mentioned, I believe President Hollande wanted to confirm his policy, which is to say that, number one, France has to tighten the belt, tackle our debts and deficits. That's the priority that we have. At the same time, France has to promote growth through structural reforms, reducing the cost of labor, bringing more flexibility into our labor market, lowering corporate taxes. And President Hollande went far into this direction in terms of pro-growth, pro-business measures. And that's why, by the way, the American investment to France is on the rise again. And the third priority under Franco-German leadership is to better organize, I would say, the Eurozone. Now the euro is a solid currency and unanimously considered as such. But we have to make sure that the coordination of the European social, economic, fiscal policies is stronger. And that's where François Hollande, the French president, and Angela Merkel, his German counterpart, are working very, very hard in this direction. So no revolution, in other words, but a confirmation of the pro-growth, pro-business, pro-innovation priority in France. And I would say that, as I used to say, innovation is for the country and for me as ambassador, the number one, number two, and number three priority.
Well, and within that, is there something that speaks to the place of the United States and perhaps the Midwest in particular, the importance of the economic relationship between this part of this country and the innovation that's taking place in France?
Yes, that's why I'm so happy to be here today, because obviously we have a special relationship between France and Milwaukee. This is based on our shared history and values, on Marquette and Joliet, the Alliance Française that is so active in this place. The fact that I learned that you have the longest Bastille Day celebration in the country, 4 days, that is really amazing. So that's one pillar, which is shared values and history. And at the same time, the economic partnership between France and Wisconsin is growing stronger every year. France is one of the leading foreign investors, not only in the United States, but also in Wisconsin, with more than 10,000 jobs supported in the state by French companies. More than 30 French companies are very active in Wisconsin and increasing their activities there. And that's one of the reasons why I'm here today for three key events. So to answer your question, yes, we are walking on two pillars, shared values and history, but also cross-investment, job creation, innovation, and that's where the partnership between France and Wisconsin is literally booming.
One of the things that you do in representing the French, in representing France here is you also represent French culture, and I'm curious what do you find people in this country most interested in and curious about when you speak with them?
That's a good question. I think on the cultural front, across the ups and downs of the Franco-American partnership over the last decades, you know, there has always been a very good understanding, a good partnership in this respect. In other words, culture is beyond politics. Is really at the core, I believe, of our relationship. And as I said, the Alliance Française, being so active here in Milwaukee, is a good illustration of this. You know, in the United States, you have more than 2 million people speaking French on a daily basis. So, of course, compared to the American population, it's not that huge, but it's growing, contrary to what some people can believe. And French is the second taught foreign language in American schools. which is quite amazing. And the demand for French teaching is increasing quite strongly in this country. The question for us is to be able to find the corresponding offer. In other words, the number of teachers able to teach French. But the demand for French is just booming. So I'm a very happy ambassador.
Well, and it's interesting because I was thinking about this. You are not only, you know, the ambassador of foreign policy as it's carried out and economics as they are carried out, but people must see you as representative of everything from Claude Monet to Edith Piaf to François Truffaut.
You want me to sing here, right?
Well, if you're comfortable with it.
I think your audience will regret it. No, it's true. It's true that French, I mean, the culture is really part of our DNA. It's part of what we are, what we like the most, what we want to fight for. And that's why I'm so glad that French culture and language are, thriving in the United States, that francophonie, as we say, the francophone family, is so well and alive in this country that the demand for Alliance Française, French schools, literally from coast to coast, is booming. So it's part of, my efforts I do day after day. Yeah.
Well, Ambassador François Delattre, thank you so much. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you so much.
François Delattre has served as the French ambassador to the United States since 2011. He was in Milwaukee this week to speak to a gathering of the Milwaukee Rotary Club, and he also met with state and local leaders at the Global Water Center. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich. Coming up next, on International Workers' Day, we'll look back at a defining moment in Milwaukee's labor history, the Bayview tragedy. Stay tuned. We'll be back with that conversation in just a moment when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's May Day, and it's also International Workers' Day. More than 80 countries around the world will celebrate the working class today and the bitter and often bloody fights for labor rights and laws that most of us now enjoy, including the 8-hour workday and weekends. The date was chosen to commemorate the Haymarket Massacre just south of us in Chicago that occurred on May 4th in 1886. The fight for the 8-hour workday had been taking place around the country, and Milwaukee wasn't immune to the conflict between businesses and workers. Monday, May 5th marks the 128th anniversary of the incident known as the Bayview Tragedy. Privately owned militia shot and killed striking workers at Milwaukee Iron Company's rolling mills. It was not a spontaneous event. May 1st just marks the beginning of the turmoil that led up to the tragedy. Ken Germanson, who was president emeritus of the Wisconsin Labor History Society, explains to Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson how the turmoil began.
Well, May 1st had been set at that time in 1886 as kind of a nationwide goal, by which time a lot of the labor movement had hoped to establish the principle of the 8-hour day in many of the factories and industries throughout the country. And that had been a major goal for some years. That really dates way back. And it had been rarely attained except in various things. So kind of led by the Knights of Labor and a few other of the national organizations at that time, they said, we're going to have it by May 1st or else we'll have general strikes throughout the country. And there were indeed a number of general strikes that occurred on May 1st. And just as a quick aside, May 1st became the National Workers' Holiday, which has been recognized throughout the world as the Workers' Holiday, except in the United States where we've selected Labor Day, which is a result of concerns back in the 1890s when they were looking at this stuff, that May 1st was identified too much with the more radical causes.
May 1st was a national decision, but how was Wisconsin overall? Did they seem to reform by May 1st and say, let's do the 8-hour day? Or were they more or less not wanting to follow that?
Well, in fact, very few places followed it. So there were strikes throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Baltimore, Chicago, St. Louis, and actually Milwaukee was probably one of the more active sites, because we had two efforts going, one on the north side and one on the south side, because we were by then already a very industrialized city. And the industrial, you know, revolution, as great as it was taking a great toll on working people who worked an average of 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and they didn't have any coffee stations or lounge breaks.
And then was this also before the child labor movement?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, there were child laborers involved and so forth. I mean, all of the horrors of the early industrial age were still being foisted upon workers, and they were getting about $1 a day, which, you know, forced them to, you know, live in cramped quarters and squalid conditions. Yeah.
So were there other strikes happening around the city at that time then?
Yes. Well, actually, the plants were basically closed in the north side by mainly German workers. This was a very ethnic city, the north side being German, the south side Polish, and some of the other ethnic entities. And they were closed. The breweries were closed, and some of the other shops up there were closed. And on the south side, virtually all of the shops were closed, with the exception of the Bayview Rolling Mills, which was at that time our city's, you know, largest employer, with with over 1,500 workers.
So let's talk about the massacre itself. Was this intended to be a peaceful riot?
Well, yeah. In fact, I kind of resent your use of the word riot, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because that's would indicate that the workers were violent. Mm-hmm. And no, they had no guns. It just wasn't done in those days, frankly. And they started with peaceful marches on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of May. And they had gradually emptied out all of the shops on the south side, all of the major ones, with the exception of the rolling mills. And so they were marching towards those mills every day to try to urge the workers to come out, or to force management to just close the shops and, you know, basically have the workers join them. Well, that didn't happen. On May 3rd, seeing all this, Governor Jeremiah Rusk called out the state militia and said, well, we're going to protect this employer. And on the 4th, the troops showed up in front of the headquarters. Now, the workers marched in, and then one of the companies was surrounded by the troops, and they got upset, and so they fired guns into the air. And the workers responded by throwing rocks and a few things like that. So there was some violence on the 4th, which, as I recall, was a Tuesday. On Tuesday night, May 4th, the Haymarket event happened in Chicago. And that was widely publicized. And that was a rally for working people where a bomb had been thrown, nobody knows by whom, and killed 8, including four police officers, plus the others were, you know, people who were there at the rally. That alarmed Governor Rusk and the industrialists and the corporate chieftains here in Milwaukee. So they were very alert and brought in some more companies of state militia for May 5th. So what happened then, on May 5th, everybody gathered at St. Stanislaus Church on South 5th and West Mitchell Streets and marched to the mill, about a mile and a half march, east on Mitchell, south on Kinnikinick, and east on Bay Street. And the militia was stationed up on top of the hill, which is approximately where DeMarini's pizza place is. And the marchers came up Bay Street, which is lower level, And at 200 yards out or further, the colonel ordered the marchers to stop. Well, there was no loudspeakers in those days, so they didn't hear and they kept marching. And at that point, well, the governor had given them orders to stop the marchers under any cause. So at that point, the colonel said to his men, "Pick out your man, take aim, and kill him," and ordered the volley of shots into the crowd. They ended up killing seven, including a man feeding his chickens in his backyard and a 12-year-old boy who skipped school to see all what was going on. And, of course, that ended the march right at that point, and everybody scattered, and there were wounded, we don't know how many. So that was the massacre itself.
So I read someplace that the workers had its own kind of a militia in a way. Did they have an army or support?
No, you may have confused that with the militia troops that were brought in, because the militia was composed of citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, the Kosciuszko Guards were one of the groups, and they were Polish. So it was their neighbors that were walking in front of them, and there's considerable belief that there would have been more dead, but most of them fired over the heads of the marchers.
So who was Paul Gratkow, and how was he involved?
Well, Paul was one of the leaders. He was a Knights of Labor leader, and he had become a very major speaker. He was a socialist and believed very strongly in these causes. So he was one of the leaders.
So then what was his aftermath? Because I saw that he was arrested.
Well, he was arrested, and it was, in fact, they arrested, I believe, more than 30 of the marchers. They didn't hold them very long, a little different than Chicago, because down there, which is a story all unto itself, they arrested 8 and sentenced them to hang. Just some of them weren't even at the site at the time, but they arrested them for inciting. They were claimed to be anarchists or terrorists, which was the equivalent of what we would think of as communists in the worst order today, or shall we say the terrorists that some people fear now. So people were scared at that time about anarchists, and 4 of them were hanged, 1 died in jail, and 3 were pardoned. And that was very tragic. Here in Wisconsin, they did arrest some of them, but at that time, the sentiment was totally on the side of the militia, not on the side of the working people, because the media at that time called these things riot, and they indicated that, you know, this was an unruly bunch of people. And actually, terms like riffraff, well, that wasn't the exact term, but they used terms indicating that these people were no good. But there are forebears in this community, our great-grandparents, as it were. My own grandfather at that time, as far as I can tell, was employed at the rolling mills. My family's basically from a Bayview, though I grew up elsewhere, and I now live in the area. So, you know, I feel very close to all of this.
Definitely. And that must have been how you got involved with.
Yeah, that was it. And I was among a handful of us that started to begin to hold this event in 1986, which was the 100th anniversary. And we did a number of things among our participants all the way through up until his death in 2005 or 6 was a former Milwaukee mayor, Frank Zeidler. And Frank was, and he spoke at every one of our events, and everybody wanted to hear what he wanted to say up until his death at age 93.
Wow.
And this was one of his major events, because we wanted people to remember this event because it was part of our struggle for the 8-hour day. We're still struggling to, in effect, keep the 8-hour day. And why we think this is relevant today is, well, first of all, there's some state legislators that would like to screw up the 40-hour week. There's other things that would extend working hours for people without having to pay overtime or break state laws. So that's a very immediate issue as to why this is important, because working people basically died for this. And the other reason this is important is because what this set off after 1886, in spite of the fact that it was an immediate failure, they didn't get the 8-hour day basically until the Fair Wage and Hour Standards Act of 1938, 52 years later. But what it did symbolize and spur on people that they, if they got together collectively as a group, they could make enough noise and start making changes. And sure enough, the leadership after the thing here in Milwaukee urged folks to get involved in politics. And they did. They created a People's Party that took over the Common Council that very November of 1886. They were later beat out by a fusion between the Democrats and Republicans. And for a period of nearly two decades, this fusion ran Milwaukee with great corruption. And that ended with the election of the first socialist mayor in Emil Seidel in 1910. And we continue to have a series of socialist mayors until Frank Zeidler's retirement from the office in 1960. And there were some breaks in there of 2 and 3 years of other mayors. But the folks went back to socialism. And Milwaukee gained a reputation through all those years and kept it of creating an efficient, effective, and dedicated government. And John Girder, who's a prominent Milwaukee historian, claims that a lot of those reform activities developed as a result of this event in 1886. That's why we think this is worth saluting. Every year we get around 300 or more folks gather in around us. We have about an hour ceremony at the corner of South Superior and East Russell, just up from the Coast Guard station there. We hope the weather will be warmer than what we've had, so we make for a good day. Also at our event on Sunday, we'll have a reenactment of the actual tragedy put on by the Milwaukee Public Theater. We'll have a cast of not thousands, but 20s, and there'll be some larger-than-life-size puppets taking over the words of Jeremiah Rusk, who some of the participants will boo, and of Paul Grotkow. We certainly welcome folks out there for that, because that's become a very popular feature of these annual events.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Ken, for joining us on Lake Effect. You have given us so much knowledge about this significant event in Milwaukee history.
Thank you very much.
Ken Germanson is President Emeritus of the Wisconsin Labor History Society. This year's commemoration of the Bayview tragedy will be held on Sunday at 3 p.m. on the corner of South Superior Street and East Russell Avenue. Germanson spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. We'll take one last break, and then we'll have an in-studio concert with guitarists Peter Lang and Lucas Michalides. Stick around for more of Lake Effect on WUWM right after this. We're back with more of Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. The fingerstyle guitar program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee not only trains the next generation of guitarists, but it also brings in world-class musicians to teach and perform. Tonight, two giants of the guitar world, Peter Lang of Minnesota and Lukas Michalidis from Australia, will give a free concert at the Zelazo Center. The two men are both guitarists, but they have very different styles. Lang plays the country blues, cakewalks, and rags, while Michalidis is more lyrical and atmospheric. Because their sounds are so different, we ask them each to perform a song. Michalidis will play in a moment, but right now we're hearing Lang with his version of Snake Array's Come and Gone. Peter Lang, thank you so much. Snake Array's Come and Gone, and you are listening to us in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. And now, Lukas Michalidis is going to entertain us, and the tune is Picking for Olive. Lovely. Wow, that was wonderful. Lukas Michalidis, thank you so much. And Peter Lang also in the studio. And you gentlemen are here to perform tonight at Milwaukee Unplugged. And how did you guys get together? Because you don't normally play together, do you? Was this just like a programming thing and you knew you just got together? Or
yeah, that sounds...
Yes.
That's the long answer and the short answer. Mm-hmm.
Had you played together before? Have you been on the same? So had you met before?
No. I met Peter last night for the first time, actually.
No.
And so this is the first time you're actually performing together here in the studio.
It is, yeah.
Right. That's pretty
dining,
cool.
Dining together for lunch, and now we're playing in the studio, and then we're going to perform together, and perhaps we'll go out and bend an elbow or something.
After that, yeah, maybe the worldwide tour is coming next, right?
Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah.
A lot of merchandising as well.
Exactly.
To look forward to.
Got to work on that.
Yeah. T-shirts like this and that.
Yep. Well, Peter, you have been on the scene since the 60s doing this stuff, working with John Fahey and also Leo Kottke, who's been in, you know, he's played for us as well. And I think I first heard you on a Tacoma release, you know, a gazillion years ago.
Yes, gazillion, that's about right.
How has the guitar world changed in all of that time? Because you've been playing pretty much that whole time.
Well, you know, it's interesting if you reflect back as to what was going on then. Radio was really pretty abysmal, but it was freeform. You know, when the Telecommunications Act or whatever was came in and allowed the merger of all these radio stations. In those days, radio was very strong. Each radio station had its own programmer. And a lot of times the cream would rise to the top. And I think it would be very difficult. Paul McCartney even said if the Beatles were to come out today, we'd never make it. Real music is played on stations like this. And it gets tougher and tougher. There's really probably only 400 to 500 good radio stations left in this country, and it's hurt a lot of musicians. Okay, that's the bad side. The good side is when I left the music business, which I did several times in the late 70s, John Fahey and I joked about putting guitars in a closet like they did with accordions in the 50s. And what's happened is young people are playing good music. I mean, not just fingerstyle, but jazz and classical, and it's taken off, and I think part of it is because the music is commercial music is so bad, people just feel compelled to, well, if I'm going to listen to music, I'll make my own. So I think there is kind of a renaissance. You particularly see it in, you know, places like YouTube and MySpace and Facebook. It was really heartening for me last night, for example, to see all these young people in the audience.
Yeah.
I mean, times are changing, but I think also people are hungry for music, good music, and the joy of music, and that comes from participating. That comes from seeing live music, not buying, you know, or watching music videos, but to go see live music, to perform live music, to become part of it. And when I played in Europe, I didn't sell many CDs. I was in Ireland, and my tour manager said, well, in Ireland, if they have a choice of seeing a live show or buying a CD, they don't have much money. They'll do the live show every time. And that's something I say to people is, you know, if you want music, you have to support it. You have to support the live musicians. You have to go out. And people are doing that. I mean, it's very heartening.
Lucas, do you find that to be the case? You haven't been on the scene as long as Peter, but is that true?
Which aspect?
That you see more people participating, that young people are coming to music and they're playing and they're at your concerts and they're interested.
I'm not sure if that's been my experience, actually. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's entirely true. But certainly I agree with what Peter's saying about if you want the music and the art to survive, it's essential to be supporting it. And I remember reading once upon a time, it was this book written by an author, and she was saying, if you want to become a writer, make sure you buy a book a week because you're basically sustaining the industry. And I think that's a really great motto. And, you know, I'm not sure. I sometimes feel like this new youthful kind of internet generation seem to just expect everything for free. So I have sort of mixed opinions.
Yeah, the monetary part of it has never really quite worked out. So at least it hasn't so far, you know, for musicians.
Exactly.
It's still a hard way to make a living.
I'd say it's more the model. Things like Spotify or whatever, you know, they're not being fair. They're not sharing properly. I think if they had a good system set up, like, you know, when Radiohead came out with their album, I don't know which one it was, where they said, pay whatever you want. I think the average price was $8, and it was a huge hit. And I don't think that the consumers aren't willing to support the artists. I just don't think they have a means or a way to do it other than a performance or an MP3 on Spotify or iTunes or something.
People are kickstarting a lot. I've seen a lot of albums go that way. People are, you know, raising money to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And I know that at least gets the initial cost of the album made. Whether it sustains the band or the performer afterwards, I'm not sure. But it seems to be another model that's popped up.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And the people who are supporting those campaigns are their fans.
Yeah.
Are the people that appreciate their music. And they want to help. And as I said, I think if there was a proper model, artists would be well supported. A phenomenon for me in the last 10 years is the rise of house concerts, where, you know, people are thrilled to bring you and pay you well or fairly and give you a nice meal and a chance to meet some great folks. And those for me have been more fun than big shows anytime. And I've had some big house concerts. I had one. There were 120 people there, but it was a rather large house. And it just stunned me. I made more money at that house concert than I did the whole rest of the tour combined, and sold CDs. And again, if there's a model that allows people to do this, to participate, to see, then I believe they will be supported. And I think we're seeing ways that that's happening.
What about touring? Are you guys touring a lot? I mean, Lucas, are you out on the road?
I don't do enough. Well, I've got a young family back home in Australia, so I do that to a limited degree. I'm involved in another group. It's like a Russian world music ensemble from Australia, and we do tour fairly regularly. But, yeah, with a solo thing, I do it occasionally. The reason why I'm here at the moment, I'm doing an artist in residence at the university, UWM, as part of the guitar sort of studies and degree course. So I know John Stropes quite well. And this is kind of, I don't know if I'd call this a tour. I'd call it a musical adventure, actually. And, you know, it's been wonderful for me because I've been doing some teaching. I've been taking some presentations and also performing, and it's been a really great exchange of fingerstyle information all around.
Well, and this program is unique.
It is. It's unlike anything in the world.
You guys both know John from quite a way back.
And, you know, I'm not convinced that a lot of Milwaukee is aware of what's happening at that place, but it's, you know, highly sought after place. You know, it's the envy of the whole world in terms of a guitar program. There's nothing like it. And it's because of his, you know, John Stropes's commitment and integrity he's brought to it. And it's been a real pleasure for me to witness his workings with students and what, you know, he's really high kind of, he's very ambitious, you know, and cares. And it's been really great to see that, to be involved.
Peter, have you also been involved, like, in a residency here?
Not here, no.
Yeah.
You know, John and my relationship go way back. We wrote a book together, and we've done quite a bit together. And I've done quite a few things with John. I've never done a residency. And, you know, today that would be a little bit difficult. I actually am a legend in my spare time. I work part-time. And also do my music, but I work for a company, computer support. And you were asking about touring. I stopped touring in 2008 in part because I'm getting old. It's hard to tour. Mm. The economy's been bad, and you know it just isn't worth it for me to go night after night for a little bit and then have a few nice concerts. So what I've been doing is mainly festivals. Or dates like this. I think I've only had 4 dates this year, and 3 of them have been festivals. They're fun. They pay well. They treat you well. And, and then I just...
then you can go home.
And then I go home.
Yeah, which is kind of important, too.
And I have a family, too, so...
I want to end with music, and because you each have your own things, you know, we're going to each have you play an individual tune. Is there a possibility of getting you guys to jam on a thing together? I know you've never done it before, but
I've never done it. Unprecedented.
Let's wrap up, and then we'll see how
it goes.
Right.
All right.
If they hear a fifth song, we'll know it worked.
Exactly. There you go. If they don't, it's like, okay, it was a great idea. So, Lucas, do we want to start with you? Because we started with Peter at the top of the show. Sure. What are you going to play for us?
Very quick tune here. So this piece is entitled "Breathe." And it's one that I've recently actually both these pieces that we're hearing today have recently been recorded on a new piece of work or new CD, I should say. This one takes me to my father's deathbed, basically. He was in death rattle. He had a death rattle for a couple of days before he passed away. So it just sort of takes me right there. Anyway, it's called "Breathe."
Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much. Lucas Michaelides with Breathe. And Peter, you're going to take us out with what?
Originally known as the Chalkline Walk, and later became Colored Aristocracy. It's a cakewalk from the 1840s. I first heard it on Taj Mahal on the banjo. He did it on the banjo, and I mean, I guess he heard it from the New Lost City Ramblers or somewhat. I had no idea the history of it. I did bring you an album, Testament, which was kind of my testament to it's all the music that I learned to play the guitar from. None of it I wrote myself, but it's kind of a journey back through the traditions that brought me forward, blues and country music and so forth.
That's guitarist Peter Lang with his version of Chalkline Walk. Before that, we heard Lucas Michaelides with his original tune, Breathe. The two guitarists hadn't met before yesterday, and they played together for the first time here in our studio. The tune they improvised together, Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do, is on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect, and it's very much worth a listen. You can hear all of the songs they performed there as well. Lang and Michaelides performed tonight at the Zelazo Center for the Performing Arts on the campus of UWM as part of the MKE Unplugged series. The concert begins at 7:30, and it's free. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.